Hello, this is Down the Back of the Seats. I'm Ellen, cinema manager at Campbelltown Picture House.
And I'm Alistair, a film and theatre maker based on the Isle of Mull.
And Alistair, what is this podcast about?
This podcast explores what happens when the public and public spaces meet. What's left behind? What's been found that's unexpected? What stories are there to tell? It's tales from behind the scenes of the cinema, theatre, concert hall, or even Twitch stream, wherever people meet, linger, and leave things or bits.
And as Alistair has hinted at there, we've got a guest today. We are talking to Robert Hartley, who was an employee of mine, in fact, back in New Zealand. He worked for me at the cinema, but now makes his living as a Dungeons & Dragons games master. And as Alistair said, uses Twitch and brings a whole new meaning to bits, as we discover in the interview.
It's also a quite heavy on me. You'll hear a lot of my voice in this one, so I do apologise if you can't stand me, but never mind.
Because I was out of my depth as soon as we started talking about story structure and fantasy realms. I clammed up and just sat there going, Yep. So we started recording and we just started chatting. And then the bit that wasn't originally meant for the podcast, I've chucked in anyway because Alistair, of course, immediately started talking about Pooh. So that's where we're going to start with. Here is Rob Hartley, Alistair Satchell, and me,
Ellen Mainwood,
talking about Pooh.
Thank you.
What time of day is it here? It's 10:05 at night.
Gosh, thank you so much for being up this late doing that. That's really appreciated. That's
thank you. Normally up this late, I'm a night owl.
That's great. Yeah, and do you kind of are you doing sessions at this time of night as well?
Not this week. But yes, sometimes I will be playing games until well into the night. I've got a DM for hire game with a sort of an ongoing thing with a group that often hires me from like 6 p.m. till midnight-ish.
Oh, 6 hours that's a long time to spend in a fantasy realm. That's amazing. Do you have to like stop and have a fantasy poo and things like that as well? Like,
you can. In fact, yeah. It's funny that that's one of the first questions you ask, because I recently wrote a comedy skit series for YouTube that's just started coming out this week. The first episode dropped this week.
Thank you.
I cast the spell of Choclomancy. Excuse me.
Yeah, and one of the episodes is them all sitting down in a tavern, and one of them going, "Have any of you guys ever pooed?" Because for that exact reason, like when you never role play the mundane things
exactly,
in your character's day to day life.
My dwarfs run out of toilet paper. Fantastic. Or would an elf? No, they do it by, I don't know. It's interesting, like Star Trek, when it represents toilets, I think it's only Star Trek 5 or something like that, where you see someone staring at a toilet going, "What do I do here?" It's quite dark. yeah, great. Rob, can you explain a little bit about, for the listener, about how you make your living?
Sure. I'm Robert Hartley. I'm a full-time Dungeons & Dragons content creator. I'm most well known for being the DM for a comedy group called Viva La Dirt League, but I do D&D content in my own right at Robert Hartley GM all over the internet. So what do I do? I make Dungeons & Dragons content on Twitch, on YouTube, and then I have a minor following on other platforms, because there's a million social platforms these days, so Instagram and all the rest of it too. I'd say the majority of my stuff is Twitch related, so I guess we'll start with that. It's not a place where I have to worry about people leaving stuff or bits, thankfully. Or at least they do, but in a very different fashion. It's very funny that when I listen to your podcast and I hear you talking about people leaving bits, because bits is literally a thing that is in Twitch that I earn money from. They're called Twitch bits. And
if you're going to Twitch your bits on this podcast, boy, I'll.
They're called Twitch bits. And it is people buy them in bulk from Twitch for, X amount of money, and then they give them to the streamers that they enjoy at a rate of 1 bit is 1 US cent. So if somebody said, if it says so and so just donated 100 bits, then they've just given me a dollar.
Oh,
And it's
lovely.
kind of like online busking. So yes, so people leaving me bits is these days much nicer than when I used to work at the cinema with Ellen. Oh yeah, I should also
Yes.
mention, Ellen and I have known each other for many, many years from when I used to work at a cinema in Pukekohe.
Yes, I used to manage a cinema in Pukekohe, New Zealand, and Rob worked for me and was
I was
my
the best
sanity.
person there.
That is genuinely true. No,
And
no.
where are you from
No,
originally, Rob?
everyone was lovely, but yeah, Rob, you were my sanity, I think.
Where are you from originally, Rob? Which part of is it Yorkshire you're from?
Correct. Yeah, I'm from Leeds originally.
Ah, nice.
Moved to
Fantastic.
New Zealand in 2007, and I talked like this, and people couldn't understand a word I was saying. So I had to neutralize accent a bit, otherwise we don't understand.
Your accent is so Kiwi now. Way more than when I knew.
I mean, Brits tell me it's Kiwi, but the Kiwis still say I sound British.
I suppose.
And
You guys will pick up on the fact that I say things like water. I'm drinking some water and stuff, and that's very
water.
New Zealand.
And if you're on the deck, it's something else entirely as well. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, this isn't sitting out on the deck, enjoying a drink.
And Leeds, did you ever work in kind of you must have been very young when you left Leeds. Were you kind of like 17,
I was
18?
18.
Oh,
Yeah, I was 18 when
fantastic.
I left
Wow, and
New
straight to New
Zealand.
Zealand.
Yeah, straight to New Zealand.
That's
Moved
brilliant.
to
Did
New
you have
Zealand.
family in New Zealand or something, or
I
did you
followed
just?
my parents out, yeah.
Oh, nice.
My parents came out. I was at college doing drama, and so I stuck around another 6 months or so to finish that college. And when I finished, I followed them out, and I got my residency through my dad's visa. I kind of just was doing it to be like keep options open, because if I arrived by a certain date, I'd get permanent residency on through his visa. And then I was like, and then at least I've got my options. I can always move to New Zealand if I want to. But I just never looked back. I just moved to New Zealand and was
Ah,
like, oh, this is where I want to live.
that's wonderful. And drama,
Yeah.
what drama college did you go to, and has that influenced your work with Dungeons and Dragons?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So I pursued acting for many years. So I went to Wakefield College to do
Oh,
drama.
aye.
Got a BTEC National Diploma in Performing Arts Acting. And then I moved to New Zealand and was like, all right, is there a New Zealand drama school? Oh, yes, there is one. And I went to that and got a degree,
Lovely.
Bachelor of Performing Arts. And then I pursued acting for many years until in 2017. I was like, this isn't bringing me joy anymore. It was
Yeah.
like, I literally had a workshop where the homework was think about sort of the what makes you happiest when you're acting, and we'll use that as part of an exercise tomorrow. And I went home and did this homework by having to reflect on when I was happiest last. And I was like, oh, when I was doing this like in amateur dramatics when I was 15, that's probably when I was last happy doing it. And since I pursued it as a career, it just adds in so much stuff that I just didn't enjoy, all of the like networking and the bullshittery around that sort of stuff. Yeah, I didn't like
That's
any of
permanently
that
sad.
extra stuff. And so I was like, you know what? I went back the next day and was like, I don't think I'm happy doing acting. I'm gonna quit. And the teacher was not wanting that exactly from the exercise. That was not what they'd intended of this acting exercise. But at least it
They
made
shot
me
themselves shortly
happy to make that
afterwards.
decision. Yeah. So I went just straight away the next day. I was like, right, I'm going back to university. I'll get a quote unquote real job. I started studying mathematics. Well, I started studying a whole bunch of math in year
No
because
way! Good God!
I don't know what I'm doing, but I know that I was always good at science. I was always academically minded. So I went back to university and I started studying a bit of everything. In the first semester, I took a paper of chemistry, biology, astronomy, everything. Very quickly was like, not chemistry. No, thank you. Not for me. And little by little, it all kind of fell away until maths and physics was left. And I graduated 3.5 years later with a Bachelor of Mathematics, just at the same time that COVID hit and my Dungeons and Dragons career took off. And I was like, oh, now I have to decide if I've gone back to university and got this freaking student loan, the second student loan, to now get a degree in something that I'm not going to use because now I'm going to go back into a creative field. Am I going to do it? Yeah, sod it. Let's do it. Let's bite the bullet and give it a go. And thankfully, it worked out really well.
Oh, amazing.
And as some of my fans point out, an acting degree and a maths degree is kind of a Dungeons and Dragons degree because it's storytelling with numbers. And that's
Yeah.
exactly what Dungeons and Dragons
It
is.
was all coming to this. Were you playing Dungeons and playing Dungeons and Dragons? Doing Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, you
Pl
play. It
playing
is a game.
playing playing Dungeons and Nugget
That's what the
Dragons.
G of RPG stands for, role-playing
Okay.
game.
Were you doing that recreationally throughout? When did you start?
Yes, I discovered it around the same time that I gave up acting, and immediately it was like drugs in my veins. I was like, oh, I need more of this immediately. It was scratching the itch of storytelling and putting on silly voices and stuff that acting always used to be, like amateur dramatic acting. And then I just got really good at it. And eventually a friend of mine put us in touch with the Viva La Dirt League guys and was like, I think Dungeons and Dragons would be good for your content, and I happen to know a guy who's really good at it, and he put us in touch, and the people who liked it really liked it, and we
Oh, that's
decided
lovely.
to make a thing of it. Yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah. So, Rob, with the nature of the audience in online stuff is not exactly the same as a physical audience in a space where, as we said about leaving bits, but what is the relationship with the audience in Twitch compared to the real life? And how do they not betray who they are, but how do they leave kind of elements of really who they are? What are the things at the side of your eye, the liminal stuff within the Twitch communities? And also, how much, the third question of seven, how much of that do you have to absorb or ignore when you're creating this dramatic unity that you're creating?
The thing that I've noticed above all else when I started streaming and started finding success through streaming was this thing about parasocial relationships. That's been the biggest thing for me, a one-sided relationship, because I'm performing to my stream, to my monitors, to my screens. I'm looking at a webcam, and all I'm seeing of my audience is names on a screen.
Yes.
They're in my chat, and so I see their names popping up, and they're giving me bits, and they're like, it's like I'm an online busker, as I mentioned before. So they're giving me small amounts of money, and it's adding up because, the audience is large enough that it all comes together. But from their perspective, they're seeing me every day, and I'm talking to them. They see my mannerisms, and they hear my voice and how I speak, and they get to know my quirks. They get to know me when I'm bleary-eyed and only just waking up, when I'm doing a morning stream. They get to know me when I'm delirious with exhaustion at the end of the day. When whatever my streams are, they see me at all these different times. And so for my fans, for my audience, it's quite often that they will think that they know me and that I know them. But from my perspective, half the time, I don't even know what gender they are. I don't know where they're from. I don't know what country they're in. I know nothing about them other than a name on the screen, and the fact that they've been in my chat for several months. And then add to that the fact that some people are quite active in the chat, and they really do put themselves out there, and you do learn a bit about their personality from how they're interacting with the rest of the chat and things. And then other people are what we call lurkers, which is people who turn up to every stream and they're watching, but they never interacting with the chat, and they're subscribing, so they're paying for paying me money essentially by watching the stream, which is a thing that you can do for free. You can just watch my streams for free. But if you like my content, you might want to support me by, $5 a month for a subscription. You get slight benefits and things like no adverts and stuff like that. And so sometimes I'll get a little notification that says, so-and-so has just subscribed for 48 months in a row. And I'll be like, I don't even know who this person is. They've never chatted in my stream. Like, I don't know who they are, but for some reason they're obviously loving, they're obviously perfectly happy tuning in and watching without contributing, as it were.
That's lovely. At the same time, it's
So
yes,
the kind
there's a
of
distance to it, so strange, yeah. But it's at the same time,
So
it's kind.
it is a very interesting thing to try and navigate from the context that you were asking about, with like, how do I get to know my audience, and what is the sort of those what do they put out about themselves? It really varies dramatically. Like, I just recently hit 20,000 followers on Twitch, but I only get about 100, 200 people at most in my chats. And of those 120 people that are in my chat, only like 30 of them are probably like actively talking at any one time. So those ones I get to know quite well. Those the people who are like my super fans, as it were. And then I often see those people, those same people in my Discord server, and you get to know their personalities a little bit through that. So it's really an interesting situation to get to know your audience's personality before you even know all of those basic fundamental things about them, like how old are they, what
Yeah.
gender do they identify as, and all this stuff.
It's so that's a really very, very modern way of engaging with things. I don't use Twitch. I don't follow things on Twitch, but there's a comedian I follow whose work I find incredibly positive called David Earl, who's behind the character Brian Gittins and has done lots of wonderful things over the years. He's been really supportive of lots of emerging comedians, and one of the guys that he does a lot of work with is another comedian and film lecturer called David Edwards. And David Edwards is, you know, they've done lots of stuff together over the years. And on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, sometimes they'll put out their live feed, which is the random movie generator YouTube feed. And it's lovely watching it and seeing the same people in the stream in the morning. And like you can interact with, obviously, you can interact with the Davids, but you can also interact with the people on the stream as well. And it's really nice to get, there's a sort of sense of community built around that. I remember during COVID as well, there was the work of John Raine and Paul Litchfield. They had all sorts of stupid things they would do, these two comedians that were very, very funny people. They would have a gathering online. And because everyone was so remote in lockdown, it brought people together in such a lovely, lovely way. And Ellen as well, and I, we experienced this with
Cabin Fever.
Cabin Fever,
Yeah,
which.
just a daft podcast where they just sort of chatted, but it became a sort of bit of a community. But as somebody that
I'm
was
still friends
listen,
with lots of those people that, you know, the online, and we never met, but
yeah,
you know,
you're
still
very
keep in
good at that.
touch.
I found it a little bit. I found it awkward myself. I was sort of We had that lovely Christmas
Oh,
lunch
that's right. Yeah.
on Zoom, which
Yeah.
was really sweet, but I just felt like a bit of a fan sitting there, and that made me feel uncomfortable. You've
Yeah.
met, presumably, Rob, you've met quite a few of these people, have you now, at conventions and things?
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the reasons for why I wanted to do the in-person games that I was talking about before, that I don't know if it's made it into the podcast or not, but my in-person gaming that I'm going to be doing a lot more of this year. Whenever I'm traveling, I'm doing these private sanctum games, these ticketed events where you can come and play with me at the table in person. And one of the reasons was, you know, because it's helpful to supplement the cost of traveling. But partially it was because I wanted to finally meet people in person and
That's lovely.
put a face to the names of all of my fans that have been supporting me financially for years. And I'm like, I don't even know who you are or where you live. So come along and join one of my games and I'll actually get to meet you. So yes, at conventions and things, I have started to put names to faces, as it were.
I have a question related to the dramatic universes of Dungeons and Dragons. Now, I've never been a Dungeons and Dragons player. It kind of took off. I'm 45, so it was taking off when I was quite small. And I remember having American friends because I grew up in a town where there was an American naval base in Dunoon off the west coast of, on the west coast of Scotland. And so I was conscious of that kind of role-playing game culture emerging. It was, you know, it always seemed kind of made a lot of people very happy, which was great. But for me, my main connection to the Dungeons and Dragons universe was the fantastic cartoon that took place
Right,
with Uni and Dungeon Master and all these things. Ellen, I don't, did you ever see that at all?
I did not.
What? What? It was on BBC,
think
it wasn't ITV.
Yes, we only watched the BBC. I don't remember, my brother possibly.
Yeah,
But no.
maybe it's that year and a half, 2 year gap between us that maybe that was the
It's
window, like
that
Cities of
crucial.
Gold or whatever the slap the internet. So that for me was I was conscious of the cartoon, which I loved to bits in the last episodes as well. You know, being quite like, hey, oh, which we won't spoil for anyone who's following it through. But there was then the film.
Don't spoil this several decade old cartoon.
Well, no, it's one of these things that you, it's still a bit like, well, I can't spoil that one. But then there was the 2000s film, which was absolute horse shite.
Oh yes, the most recent one that came out, obviously just last year.
Yeah.
in preparation for that, some more D&D content creators and me, we did a series of streams called Movie Nights, spelled with a K, where we watched each of the already existing three Dungeons and Dragons movies in preparation for it, and then rated them, talked about them, give them a score in terms of instead of just like a score out of 10, we rated them for their strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, wisdom, and charisma, which are the six stats.
Nice.
Of D&D. We said, like, what are the strengths of this and what is the dexterity? And we said, like, see if I can even remember, it's a year ago now, but strength was because it's physical might and power and musculature is what strength dictates about your character. And so we were like, the strength of the movie is the physical elements, so choreography, stunt work, that sort of stuff. And we gave it a rating on that. And then dexterity was something about, I can't even remember, but intelligence was its script, like how smart was the script? Did it have good twists and turns and stuff? Charisma, I think, was special effects. I don't know. We went through and broke down the six stats of D&D and rated each of the movies on that. But my God, they pretty much all came out as a 3 out of 20, giving you a score out of 20, because that's how your stats in D&D work. It goes.
They've lost the game.
One to 20 is your stats, and every like an average human is about a 10. So anything below a 10 is below average, and so they all came out about a 3 or 4, and we're like, damn, these are awful movies.
But the most recent one, I loved to bits, and my son who does play D&D,
fantastic.
Yeah, my son who plays D&D went to Oban, the cinema across, you know, he has to get a boat to go to the cinema and see, and they had their pals out and went across. And I, the thing I love about it particularly, obviously Hugh Grant's amazing, but is the end song by Imagine Dragons. I just listen to that song every now and again. It makes me really happy. Can you say, how does that feel from, basically, because it's a realm that you own in your imagination, this collectively owned imaginative realm. How does that feel seeing your imagination rendered with fidelity or beyond?
It was fantastic. There was a lot of trepidation because of those first three. It was like, oh, is this going to actually be, is it going to do it worthwhile? Is it going to be poking fun at nerds, or is it going to be enjoying sort of the nerdy things about Dungeons and Dragons? There was lots of speculation about, like, how are they going to handle the Dungeon Master, who's a huge part of the storytelling aspect of Dungeons and Dragons, but you can't really represent it so easily on screen and stuff like this. And then we went and saw it, and the entire community was abuzz about, oh my God, it was incredible. They did such a good job of, like, it felt like an ensemble piece. One of the things that was lacking about the first three was that it felt like there was a main, they were trying for a main character with a backup group, which is just not how Dungeons and Dragons works. Your Dungeons and Dragons at its heart is collaborative storytelling. The Dungeon Master and the X number of players at the table are all equally telling a story together. And so you can't really have a main character, otherwise you're kind of doing it wrong. And so it felt like they'd done that really well. Like, for a movie perspective, they still needed what's-his-face to sort of be the main character, as it were. Chris, what's-his-face? Chris Pine, is it?
Pine, yeah.
But they still, once they introduced those other characters, it did feel like each of them, with the exception of the druid who kind of got shafted a little bit, the tiefling lady who could turn into the animals, she didn't really have a good story character arc. But everybody else kind of got a moment to shine, a moment to feel like they were the hero of that story. So yeah, a lot of people were very impressed with it, myself included.
Can I ask about the nature of, if this is okay, Alan, can I ask about the nature of storytelling in Dungeons & Dragons? Because I'm conscious of story structure and form. I don't know if this is going too far from a regular format. I'm kind of, that shelf there is all story structure stuff, story and things.
I love it.
So can I ask, when you're telling, because you basically are telling stories as you play these games and creating stories, what kind of story structures are you using? Are you using classic story structure? What are the story structures that repeat that you're aware of and you can modify or go on? Or how different is it each time? And is that what makes you unique in what you do? Your stories are why people come to you.
That is one of the things that I think does make me unique, even within the Dungeons & Dragons space, is people say that they really love the stories that I weave and how I do it. And I think that it kind of goes back to what I was saying about having an acting degree and a maths degree. It sets me apart from a lot of other dungeon masters, because it is It is some like I have studied story a lot. I've spent a lot of my life studying how stories work and how character arcs work and what the satisfying conclusions are to stories and things like this. And I follow in my Dungeons and Dragons games, I follow the 3-act structure like most of the stories do. I follow the hero with a thousand faces, the hero's journey and all this. I think about that stuff. And so when I'm telling a story from a Dungeon Master's perspective, what I do first is I get my players, whoever I'm going to be playing with for this game, and I get them to make their characters first before I've come up with anything to do with story. Because if I've got the characters, if they give me their character sheet and they've chosen to take expertise in stealth, that's them giving me information about their character. They want to be a stealthy, sneaky kind of a person, and so I can go, okay, in my games, I'm going to make sure to include every table session, I'm going to make sure that I'm including something that. Some excuse for them to stealth and do something cool. If they've taken a feat that allows them to roll with advantage, they roll twice and take the higher of the numbers, and they're more likely to succeed in X, Y, or Z. I'm like, okay, so they're telling me they want to do X, Y, or Z as part of their character. They want to be the big guy who can just do a shit ton of damage, or they want to be the person who's a really good sweet talker or whatever. And so I structure my individual sessions around that. But then, on a grander perspective, I also get the backstories that they've given me. Whether that's I woke up with amnesia 2 years ago and I've been trying to work out who I am, or whether it's, oh, here's an elaborate 6-page backstory about like I was raised in an orphanage after this, after an evil baron took out my mum with this thing, and then blah, blah, blah. Whatever they've given me, that's them telling me the type of story they're interested in telling with this character. And then I will pluck little parts from their backstory and go, who is going to be sort of the big bad evil guy at the end of this campaign, what we call the BBEG? Who's going to be the BBEG? Who are they working towards killing or defeating in some manner or another? And I'll usually pluck that from their story elements. Oh, this guy talked about the evil baron that killed his mother. So the evil baron is probably going to be maybe not my final guy, but whoever the evil baron is working for
A
behind the
vassal of,
scenes, like
yeah.
maybe like an arch devil, fiend, demon, whatever, that's he's actually the one pulling the strings. Maybe he's going to be the final guy. And then when I'm telling a story, I'll usually start at the end and go, if this is going to be the final guy that I fight, what needs to happen in the story in order to get them to that moment in a satisfying way? And I'll tend to turn to a 3-act structure at that point and go, like, okay, I want this, I want that, and then I want this. And that'll be the satisfying thing. And that's the same whether I'm doing a one shot, like a single 3-hour game, or whether I'm doing a campaign that's going to last 3 years. Like, I'll still think about it in act structure.
That's amazing. Thank you. It reminds me of the work of Stephen Donaldson. You know, those find your own adventure books. The
Yes, I read a lot of those.
do you? Yeah, because I
Yeah.
remember my mate George was very much a big fan of those when I was younger, and it was it was a lot of it was it's a very personal experience, and that's what's interesting about doing this on Twitch at such a scale. It's, hey, there we go. Look at
Yeah,
that.
choose your own adventure book right here. Look,
Yeah.
the Dragon's Den from the 80s. This particular book is older than I am.
Oh wow, that's lovely. Yeah, it's that shared experience with the Twitch audience at a larger scale. It's I guess it's yeah. What's the largest stream that you're aware of within our largest community for a single game that you're aware of in Dungeons and Dragons Realities?
The largest one by far is a stream called Critical Role. They were the ones who really sort of brought back this new wave of popularity in Dungeons and Dragons. They started about 8 years ago. And they were all voice actors. They all knew how to tell a story together. And most importantly, they knew how to shut up and wait for somebody to have their scene to its entirety. They could really take their time with their storytelling each week. They had a huge following, and it just took off in a huge way. They were originally part of Geek and Sundry, and then they split off once they got the popularity to afford it, to afford to sort of look after themselves. But they every week, even now, they get like thousands and thousands of viewers, probably like somewhere in the tens of thousands of viewers for every stream.
Good
And
God.
when they're doing something big, like the finale of an entire campaign or something, then it's quite likely that they'd probably hit 100,000 subscribers, 100,000 viewers.
Wow.
But all that said, even their YouTube channel has only just over 2 million subscribers to it. which I say only, obviously, 2 million's a lot of subscribers, but you look at some other YouTube channels, huge, huge, like the main Viva La Dirt League channel, they just do comedy skits and they've hit 6 million. And so you look at that and go, oh, if Critical Role are the largest, largest, most successful D&D stream that there is a natural like limitation within, like, it is only still at the end of the day a very niche thing that we're doing. Tabletop role play is a very niche thing, and so there is a cap.
One of the things I noticed when I'm reading fantasy is that very often fantasy, I get frustrated by the narrative forms they use of master and apprentice again and again and again. And there's a writer called Patrick Rothfuss who wrote Shadow of the Wind. I don't, have you read that? And I read the first one. I thought that's really great. That's going somewhere really nice and different. You know, the kind of the harp playing, the music. That was really lovely, really separate. And then I read the second one, and it was such. I gave up on it in a rage, because it was such a watery, pishy version of what had gone before. And then I looked at Robin Hobb's books, and it's all the Master and Apprentice, and then Silverthorn, Master and Apprentice, and it's like, fuck's sake, it's just the same story structure repeating itself endlessly,
I
and
mean,
it's.
maybe that's a staple of what fantasy is. It's like there are certain things that you must have in order to be part of a particular genre. Maybe that's one of the things that is a necessity to even call yourself fantasy.
But I don't like. I just, it just was. It was so. It was the same story with not enough variation each time. It's like,
Yeah, when you start to notice, it's one of the problems of studying stories, like you have and like I have, like you study stories, and eventually you start to see through
Yeah,
all
the
of the
mechanics.
you see through all of the surface stuff, and you start to see, oh, this is the same story. This is just Star Wars. This is just Harry Potter. This is just the same as this other one because it's following the exact same thing. Which can be frustrating if you can't turn that off while you're watching movies and you go, oh, okay, I know what the twists are going to be because we've gotten to the end of Act One now and I know
Oh, that's
what's coming.
Yamasha.
But I just find that interesting. I'm like, okay, and I know what the rest of the story is going to be. And then sometimes it really surprises me, and then I can't stop thinking about it for the next week because I'm like, how did that story really surprise me that way? And that what did I miss? And what did they set up? And was it satisfying? How would I have done it differently? How would
Yeah, how'd you subvert
I...
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Ellen, have you read much fantasy at all?
No, I am so out of my depth in this conversation that I think I'm just gonna sit here silently. I don't
Like the
even
best role
just
players do.
yeah. I don't think I've
you know stuff about storytelling though, right? You've watched a shit ton of movies, you know about what
I've
makes a
watched a
good movie,
thousand
what
billion
makes it.
books.
I've watched a shit ton of movies and read a million books. But no, I think I'm more easily surprised. I think I forget easily, more easily. And then it's like, oh, it's this story. That's
Oh, this again.
amazing.
Oh,
The
wow, that is
story.
oh,
What a
he's your
unique
father.
story. Yeah. That's why
He's
I can watch
the father.
700 Christmas films, the Hallmark Christmas films.
Oh.
Christmas, because oh no, what's gonna happen? Oh, they've got killer again.
Yesterday, my son and I went to see Hunt for the Wilder People in our local village
Oh,
hall, which
you
is,
like it?
oh God, yeah, it's I think the fourth time I've seen it, maybe the
So
second or third time I've seen it in a cinema or a cinema style location.
it's so good.
It is phenomenal. I absolutely love Taika Waititi's storytelling. I think he's a really good storyteller. I'm not too bothered about his Marvel movies. They're okay, but it's nice that someone with an independent voice is in there doing that stuff. But I was coming out afterwards, and my friend Simon's partner, in fact, Simon's wife, is from New Zealand, and she mentioned he'd m mentioned a film that she loves called Goodbye Pork Pie, which I'd love to see. And I went looking for it, and I can't find it to watch. It's 15 quid to buy a DVD, so I might do it at some point. But
Right.
that led me to a website called ondemand.nzfilm.co.nz, and the volume of films from New Zealand is fantastic. There's so many New Zealand films, and so many of them I really, really want to see, but I can't get a hold of them because there's no licensing distribution for them outside of New
Right.
Zealand with ease that I can find. And how do you feel being part of a culture that has such a vibrant and, I presume, authentic voice in its own cinema? And also, can you Excuse me for a moment while I take this call. Hold on, I'll see if I can get it. Georgia, you can get it. Thank you. Sorry, 2 seconds. My wife's got it.
Yeah, so while I was at drama school here in New Zealand, I did go through like a period of, let's see if I can watch all of the New Zealand classics.
Wow.
I should educate myself on all of the New Zealand films. And so I went and watched a whole bunch of them, like Utu and Whale Rider and
beautiful.
World's Fastest Indians, a fantastic movie as well.
I didn't know that was Kiwi film, right? Mm.
Yeah, it's
Kiwi made.
New Zealand. Kiwi made, yeah. excuse me. So we do have some incredible movies. I did have to laugh one time though when I realised that they were playing Once Were Warriors on the plane into New Zealand, on like international flight into New Zealand. I was like, this
welcome
is probably
to
not
Zealand.
The yeah, it's probably not the sort of culture that you want to be like, hey, look at New Zealand culture. It's like, no, very specific niche here. Fantastic film, but yeah, not an easy watch.
No.
I think there's the biggest problem though with New Zealand film is that well two biggest problems. One is that we don't have much of an industry. It's not big enough to support itself. Aside from Peter Jackson, you've got nothing. Like we've got incredible landscapes and stuff, so the people bring their movies here to film them and then they disappear overseas, and it's like people often go, oh, was that in New Zealand? Was that filmed in New Zealand? All of the Avatar movies, obviously. So one of the problems is that a lot of the film companies that come to New Zealand don't end up sticking around. Like it's not providing a lot of work for New Zealanders because they bring a huge chunk of their production company with them. And the other problem with New Zealand is the major runaway tall poppy syndrome that's at play here, where if anybody starts to get any kind of recognition, you get torn down in the culture because you cannot stand above the rest. Because you know they're super, super humble and all of this, and it's like you can't be seen to be succeeding, because even if you don't let the success go to your head, you'll still be seen as arrogant. You'll still be just assumed to be by default letting it go to your head, and so anybody who does end up trying to find starting to find success in New Zealand in any sort of film industry role ends up taking that elsewhere to follow the jobs and go over to Australia, go over to America, go to Canada. And so it's just a perpetuating thing where the industry never, we don't grow people and keep them here and be like, whoa, look at all these incredible, amazing filmmakers that we keep, that we have from New Zealand, born and raised, and then they also stay here and have the rest of their careers here. There's some relatively large actors from the Lord of the Rings series that are New Zealanders, and that they couldn't make a living doing it full time in New Zealand, and they had to go follow it elsewhere.
Sam Neill's maybe the exception to that rule, is because he's very visible in his presence about having a farm in New Zealand and being a.
I'm not sure what he's doing acting wise these days though.
Well, he does loads still. He's very.
Is he still working?
Well, very much so.
Oh,
yeah,
really, yeah, lots. Yeah, I'm a huge fan.
And then Jermaine and Brett, obviously the Flight of the Conchords, made a big point of being like, we're New Zealanders and we'll stay in New Zealand.
Mm. They did that even with doing the Muppet soundtrack and all that. That's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad to hear that.
I worked with Jermaine recently on a thing. Lovely guy.
I love I really love their music. I think they're really great, but I don't enjoy the comedy because it's got that humility thing of, oh, no, we're the second greatest folk band in the world. It's like, I just, it doesn't strike
not
quite true to me. I don't, it's a false humility. And whereas I like Eagle versus Shark and all that, Taika's first film, I guess, or second. I love the
first.
I will fight you. I will find you. I will. Oh, is he had? Oh, wow. It was just.
Yeah.
Ellen, can I just cast this same question to you then? You were part of a cinema culture in New Zealand, which is very much about screening these films for people, saying, you know, this is who we are, an organic expression of a culture. How does that feel in relation to what you're screening in Scotland?
It's a very similar vibe, to be fair. The way that the New Zealand audiences embrace New Zealand films to a certain extent, and the way that Scottish, you know, we'll, if when I was programming for Pukekohe, if it was a New Zealand film then we would play it because it's a New Zealand film and people would come to see it because it's a New Zealand film. And the same sort of thing in Scotland if it's a Scottish film. Do you remember, Rob, we had, do you remember Mount Zion? I think that,
Mount Zion.
That must be, that's probably still the biggest seller at Pukekohe Cinema. There's this little Kiwi film called Mount Zion, which was filmed and set. Was it set in Pukekohe as well, or was it just filmed here?
Not, I can't remember actually. It might have been. Yeah. It's definitely set somewhere in the upper North Island, somewhere in the Waikato region.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a South Auckland, Sam. What's his name? Stan.
He won New Zealand's Got Talent.
Stan Walker.
Yeah.
Stan Walker stars in it, and it's about a Kiwi Maori guy growing up on a marae, wanting to be a world famous musician kind of thing, and heavily inspired by Bob Marley. And they had Bob Marley in it, right? It was like a
There was a weird thing where
it was like before they were doing really good CGI, like making Carrie Fisher in Star Wars. Thing with Bob Marley using, really good like. Before they started doing really good CGI, maybe not like that as an example, but they used previous footage of Bob Marley visiting Marais or something, and they managed to cut together something to make it look like he was actually in the movie and something like that. But yeah, it was a funny. There's a funny story around us having Mount Zion at Pukekohe, because it was the same time that we also were showing Iron Man 3. And it is the existence of Mount Zion and Iron Man 3 that that created the game that Ellen and I have been playing ever since. Which is, I've seen a movie recently. It's about a Maori guy who grows up on a marae, but then he gets kidnapped by terrorists, and he has to create an Iron Man suit to escape or whatever. But I can't remember what the name of the movie is. And it was Mount Zion Man 3.
And the game has become then more and more.
That's beautiful.
And since then, we came up with like Godfather of the Bride. And
lovely.
It's also like
just so
Garfield
elaborate.
Of Dreams. But it's always the premise is part of the game is the premise of trying to come up with a more and more obscure reason as to why you don't remember the name of the movie, but you remember the great detail of the synopsis of what happened in it.
Oh, that's lovely.
And sometimes the people that stars in it as well.
People that star in it, like I don't know, Tom Hanks and Daniel Day-Lewis. It's like, oh, I remember that it stars Daniel Day-Hanks. The idea is to try and merge the two synopses as best you can to try and actually make them into a movie.
Yeah.
And then the other one, the person you're talking to, has to try and work out what two movies you've merged together. It's a very fun game. But I came up with that because we were showing Mount Zion and Iron Man 3.
Super.
Not many stories about bits.
No, I was trying to think. I don't remember any specific stories with us apart from you. I think I'd done some really poor programming one week where all three screens were coming out at the same time and you were the only usher or something. Yeah. And at the end of the day, you were just like, look, I'm not mad, but we are never doing that again.
let's please just give me more time between them, please.
You cannot expect me to do that ever again.
You understand that I'm not multi-man. I literally can't do three cinemas at the same time.
And get them in and see people through the door.
It was an interesting experience though, because like a lot of the ushers that we would get at that cinema would eventually just be like, oh, can I teach me how to do the coffees, and I'll do coffee machines, or I'll do this, and they would want to do other things, and I was just like, usher's the one job in this cinema that I'm perfectly happy doing. Like,
yeah,
I can bop along to Wreck-It Ralph's end credits songs and cleaning up and whatever. It's easy stuff. Vacuum under the seats, vacuum up all the bits. You know, I don't have any like major stories of like piles of body parts left behind or anything.
No, we had some. We had quite a lot
of stories on your podcast.
Yeah, we had quite a lot of vomit at Pukekohe, but apart from that, I can't really remember apart from the drugs, but I don't think you were there for the drugs, and
Oh yeah,
I've already told
no,
the drug story.
yeah,
That's brilliant.
yeah. I wasn't there for that one, but I did hear that story on your podcast, and I was like, yeah, I remember that. I remember that. I wasn't there for it, thankfully, because I don't know what I would have done. Oh, and then there was the robbery as well. That I don't think we got robbed, did we? But somebody like downstairs from us, or somebody next door, or something, got robbed at gunpoint. And I remember you having to give us all like a very impromptu staff training as to what to do if somebody pulls a gun on you. I was
Oh
like, this is
yeah,
interesting.
that's
Yeah,
right. And oh,
just give them
Dom, I
everything in the
remember.
till. No fighting.
Yeah,
Blah blah blah.
and oh God, Dom was driving me mad that we had a Dom was a bit of a like a bit of a lad,
Yeah.
and so he began. I began, right, Dom, you just hand over everything, no questions. It's absolutely fine. He's like, okay, and then he'd be like winking and be like, yeah, but I'll beat him up, right? I'll go. I'll grab the gun. But no, no, Dom. He's
There's
like.
no, don't stop reading between the lines. There are
Yes.
no lines. I'm
He's
telling,
like, yeah, I hear what you're
just
saying, but
binary.
I'm just getting what you really mean is that I should, protect. No, just yeah,
Wasn't, I'm
I've
just
forgotten
now.
that was apropos of somebody actually getting, was it the McDonald's next door maybe, or the
Yeah,
getting
someone
held
around, I
up.
can't remember. I just now remembered as well, because I was trying to go through like the layout of Pukoi Cinema, see if I could like spark anything. And I do remember sparking something actually, because when I was, so I said earlier that I got a job there for like 12 weeks over summer to earn as much money as I could before going traveling. And I went traveling for like 8 months. But we got on so well in those 12 weeks that I was like, I'll probably come back once I'm back in New Zealand, and you'll give me a job again. And so in the staff room, I put a padlock on one of the lockers in the staff room, and I left an entire scavenger hunt just dotted all over the cinema
Yes.
as to how to find the key to the lock. If you want to open this padlock before I'm
Fantastic.
back in
Oh.
8 months' time, you're gonna have to answer this clue and go up to this. And you had to, there were things taped to the bottom of certain seats, and I gave you, I think C3 was one of the seats, because I gave a clue that related to C3PO, and you had to work out
A
from
post office
that you
box,
had to
yeah.
check under C3. And
Yes.
yeah, that was fun.
How did I just not fire you on the spot? I mean, that's.
Because I'd gone
Just
traveling,
you gone,
you have a little bit
and
of
already
traveling,
left.
yeah.
I
I'd
remember that
already
was
left, mate.
amazing. We did spend quite a lot of our shifts in the office singing Les Mis,
Yeah, one
doing
day
like Les
more.
Mis times. It was great.
Yeah, good times.
Thank you so much, Rob. That was just brilliant to spend time with you. You spoke so clearly and passionately about so many of all the different things we talked about. So that was just brilliant. Really, really appreciate your time on that. And I can tell why you bring so much happiness to so many people in your work. It's just wonderful. Thank you.
Indeed. If you would like to get in touch with the podcast, you can reach us at downthebackoftheseats@gmail.com or downthebackoftheseats on Instagram and Facebook. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with waffling. Oh, I think it's possibly American Fiction Week next week. Would you like to tease that?
Yeah, American Fiction is a film that's currently on release that I saw in the cinema in Glasgow at Cineworld when I was working in Glasgow. Cineworld tickets, interestingly, from Monday to Wednesday were £5.50, which is amazing. I thought there was something wrong with that, but no, it was fantastic to draw people in. So I went to see American Fiction, which may possibly be one of the best films I've ever seen in my life.
Between now and the next podcast, I'm going to watch American Fiction. And Alistair has already said, I hope you don't like it because it'll make good podcast content.
Thank you for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.